This is episode 100 of Social Entrepreneur with Michael Crook.
You know, 3/4 of the world's GDP is 500 corporations. Business has to change the world. That's where things are going to happen. Corporate social responsibility, the environmental side of of our business, it's not going away. It's only going to become more and more and more prominent in all businesses.
Welcome to the Social Entrepreneur Podcast. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former business executive with Fortune 500 companies. Today, I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. Each week, we bring you exciting stories from the world of social entrepreneurs, benefit corporations, and impact investing. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to episode 100 of Social Entrepreneur with Michael Crook. Michael is an expert in sustainable competitive advantage that is developed at the intersection of strategy, purpose, and operational excellence. Now, he's had a rich history of leading organizations. He was at Yakima Products, who makes the Yakima car top racks. He was at Moonstone, Kelty Packs, Pearl Izumi, Revolution Living, and Prana Living. But the role that he's probably best known for is he was the CEO of Patagonia from 1999 to 2005, where he helped to turn the company around and make it one of the best places to work, a highly desirable company with a highly desirable product. There's so much richness in this conversation. I don't want to hold you back from it. I'm going to come back to you at the end and just wrap up about episode 100. But here he is, Michael Crook.
Hi there. My name's Michael Crook. Most people call me MC. I'm currently the Senior Associate Dean of Programs at the University of Oregon, and I'm the founder of Fifth Normal Form Consulting.
So what is Fifth Normal Form Consulting?
Well, it's a small boutique firm where mostly I work on strategy and leadership issues with everything from multinationals to smaller firms, usually working with the senior people and helping them to connect their strategy in their different parts of their business and really how to develop the pipeline of leadership to execute.
Are you still teaching a capstone course on strategy?
Yes, I teach advanced strategy and leadership to MBAs.
When founders or CEOs, when they're thinking about strategy, what are some of the big major components of that thought process?
Well, strategy always, there's two parts of strategy. There's the vision and where we want to be, and then there's the OE or the operational effectiveness, and they're both critical. And generally, in the center of that is a shared purpose that you try to develop within the organization, so that you understand the lens of macro values of how you make strategic decisions within an organization. So, the vision and the mission, the shared purpose, and all of that, how it maps out to strategic initiatives, and then drops down into a balanced scorecard. So, really understanding the four quadrants of a business: the people part of it, the systems part of it, the finance part of it, and then the actual product or service. So, we kind of pull all that together and try to help companies ensure that every single person in the organization understands his or her purpose in regards to that overall shared purpose of the organization.
So I hardly know where to start with your bio. you've had a really interesting career, and you started there in Oregon and left as a young man. Where were you heading when you first left Oregon?
Well, when I first left, I got on a plane for the very first time at 19 years old and went into the Navy.
Yeah. Well, what did you do in the Navy? What was your role there?
I was in the SEAL teams in the Navy.
Yeah. So that's not something that somebody hands to you, is it?
No. Although, Constantinides says, you know, 1,000 people can be in a room and something great happens, and only two or three even know what happened. And the reason is they just didn't have the frequency opened. They didn't have the channels opened up, and they didn't receive the signal. And since I had very little going for me, I applied and saw the movie of Bud's training, and you know, I didn't have a lot to lose, and so I saw it as an opportunity. And so, no, it wasn't handed to me, but in the same way, I was fortunate enough to have my eyes open and to receive the signal, and it was the best thing I ever did.
What are some of the lessons or what came out of that that you've carried forward with you to today?
Oh, the biggest thing by far is the importance of teamwork and having a shared vision or shared purpose. You know, we did, you know, amazing things. I started with, at Bud's basic underwater demolition seal training, I started with over 120 people, and only 17 of us graduated. And the only thing that we all had in common was that we were team players. There wasn't any individuals in the group. We were all team players. And you really, you know, the things that you do and you go on when you get into the teams and the things that, you know, that you achieve with a small group of people that are totally focused on one vision and total trust, it was amazing. So that would by far, that would be my biggest takeaway.
Your education, what's your education background then?
Well, my undergraduate is in forestry, and I've always been an outdoors person, growing up in Oregon, hunting and fishing and backpacking, camping, etc. So I wanted to do something outdoors, and actually I got a great job right out of school, Humboldt State University, forestry degree with a company called Pacific Lumber. It was just an amazing company with amazing values, over 100-year-old company privately owned by a family, and they had taken it public, and it was a great place to work. And then one day there was a leverage buyout, and Maxam Corporation bought the company out. And almost immediately they had us change our silvicultural practices and start clear cutting, which we never did before, and cutting close to the stream, et cetera, et cetera. And the company ended up going bankrupt. But I really wanted to understand the financial implications of that and why someone would do that to that sort of a company. And so that's when I went and got my MBA and started my career in the outdoor industry at that point.
Yeah. Now, you were at Yakima Racks for a while, right?
Yes, I was.
What led you there?
Well, I actually, with my MBA, I focused on what was then called telescience, and really, it was the beginning of a relational database, and I had a good job actually going to NASA, working as the assistant. The person was in charge of ARPANET, which was the internet at the time, and I did a weekend project for Yakima to normalize their database, and people that were there were just intriguing to me. They were all like me. They were outdoors people, and they were kayakers and runners and cyclists, and they were very, very passionate about their product. So I really found my tribe at that point, and I decided that I was going to not take the NASA job, and instead I took a $5.50 an hour job at Yakima.
So again, what I hear you talking about here are the values that are involved.
Right. You know, the owners of this company, Don Banducci and Steve Cole, they were very, very strongly oriented towards doing the right thing, doing business and doing good. That's when I first got aligned with the Conservation Alliance, which was the industry's grant giving organization. And, you know, I just thought, this is the type of person that, the type of business that I want, and the type of people that it attracts are the people I want to be around. So that's the decision I made, and it was probably the best decision I ever made.
You know, you mentioned something earlier when you were talking about the SEALs. You were saying that a signal goes out, but not everybody hears it. Right. And the same thing here where you're talking about the Pacific Lumber Company and the Yakima racks, and there were other companies. It's like there's and you mentioned the word tribe. So it seems that there are people who are attracted to that certain kind of signal. Do you think that's true?
Oh, I think it's really true. And I think it was more rare when I was a young man. You know, now that I have this opportunity to be around millennials and be a professor, it's much more prominent now. I see it. It's more the more common than the exceptions now. It's wonderful. I mean, so many of these people that I'm working with, they absolutely want to work in a job and work in a field where they feel that they're contributing and they're making a difference on this planet.
I think I first became aware of you when you were at Patagonia, and you were doing some riding. But then, do I have the timing right that you were at Patagonia 99 through 2005, but you got your PhD in 2002? Is that right?
No, I finished my PhD in 2008.
In 2008. Okay, so after you left Patagonia.
Yeah, I was doing the coursework and the writing, the dissertation, actually collecting the data from Patagonia worldwide for the dissertation. So then after I finished with Patagonia, that's when I completed it.
Yeah. So while you were there, you wrote your dissertation, and your dissertation, Revolution of Business, Mandala for the 21st Century. And so what was that all about? I mean, that's a mouthful. So what was that?
Well, it really was a study on the chair of my dissertation committee is Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, and he wrote a book called Flow. And he did longitudinal studies over many years of looking at great physicists and Nobel Prize winners and athletes and, you know, all sorts of people, people that broke paradigms, people that did things for the very first time. And he really wanted to see if there was common traits or when people got into this zone that he called flow. And when I first got the opportunity to meet him, I told him that I thought that happened in organizations when people had values that were aligned and when there was transparency, when people felt like that the strategic intent, the strategic decisions of the organization were being made through the lens of the macro values of the firm. And I told him that flow that he spoke of and wrote of, I felt happened. And that's when he told me, he said, hey, you should do a dissertation on that. That would be very interesting. So that's what I did.
Within there, you came up with this SEER model. Is that right? That was part of the dissertation?
Yes, yes. And I coined it SEER for Pepperdine. The idea of it basically is that, you know, the organizations of today, you know, if you look at what, you know, going out into the 21st century from an environmental perspective, corporate social responsibility, profit, finance, and the product or service, those are four macro values, and they're all intersecting. And you can't make a finance decision without thinking about the product. You can't make a product decision without thinking about the environment, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was the idea, is that I would put those four values out, and I would do I would go through this survey process with everyone in the company and finding out where their values were and how they intersected with the company's values. And what happened was people started really getting into these surveys, and we started making the strategic decisions of the organization completely based on those macro values. And, you know, we just started moving up the Fortune list like crazy. We went from 88th to, I don't even remember, but I think 60th to 44th to 30-something. And then the last year I was there, we were the 15th best company to work for. And so people really were satisfied. They were engaged. They were happy. They got into flow. They were more creative when they felt like they really understood the company, what it stood for. And when tough decisions were made, they didn't like those decisions, but they understood that there was a process that people went through, and it was transparent, so they supported it.
What's really interesting to me is what you're talking about now with the surveys, and it was sort of this decision, data-rich decisions that you're making internally about who you were and how you wanted to be in the world. It really had nothing you said there really had anything to do with the external environment that you're setting. So differentiation, sustainable competitive advantage, that kind of stuff.
Yes, that's I didn't say it, but it's there, absolutely. I mean, when you talk about the product or service, for instance, as a macro value, it has to be the best. It has to be either differentiated or low cost. And if it's going to be differentiated, you have to really tell the marketing story, and it has to have a reason to exist. You can't just have a product that's totally eco-groovy that doesn't work very well. You're not going to be in business. So when you talk about a sustainable competitive advantage, that means that you're doing unique things that are different than the competitors. And in our case, that's what we were doing. We were making great products. They were different. They were revolutionary. And they were, hopefully, in most cases, they were creating the least amount of an environmental footprint. So that was a competitive advantage.
Yeah. So do you think that consumers, and I'm just going to ask this, do you think that consumers really look at companies and say, well, I have product A and product B, and product A is more socially, environmentally responsible. They are better corporate citizens. I'm going to pick product A over product B?
I think absolutely. And yeah. I was fortunate enough to write a peer-reviewed journal with a couple of Harvard professors about this very topic. It's called A Customer's Willingness to Pay. And two like products, what is the price elasticity for a product where they believe that has social good? And what we found with Patagonia in a study with organic cotton is that we could charge up to 11% more without changing our demand curve if we told our story well. If we told that this is the reason that you don't want to buy a conventional cotton t-shirt, this is how many pesticides, this is the insecticides, this is what happens to the workers, this is documented, and here's organic cotton, still not a great product from an environmental point of view, but if we told that story well, we could charge up to 11% more and there was no change to the demand curve at all.
What about attracting, retaining, engaging employees? Did you see statistically a difference because of the culture that you're creating?
Very much so. We at the beginning in 99, when I went to Patagonia, it was actually for sale. It was not doing very well. And it was sort of let's get this thing sold so that, so we don't lose any more value in the legacy value, if you will, for the company. And there wasn't that sense of we are the best. We are the best. We are leading. We are in front. And as we started getting on that, doing these surveys, doing well, doing better financially, and really growing our bottom line and becoming a successful organization all around, the number of applications, just even, sometimes we would have 300, 400, 500 applications for an individual job. And we were getting the best and the brightest. People wanted to be there. And all of a sudden there was this like, wow, Patagonia is the place to be. And turnover was almost non-existent. I mean, it was to get people, for people to come in and get into the business, the incredible backgrounds and CVs. They were joining the retail stores and working on the shop floor and just wanting to prove themselves and work their way in. So absolutely, and to this day, Patagonia is still an incredible, incredible place to work.
Yeah. If you think about, so I've mentioned sort of the customer facing, and then we mentioned the internal facing. Are there other dimensions or other pieces of the ecosystem that we didn't talk about?
I guess you're referring to just stakeholders in general.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, how did you think about other stakeholders? Who were those other stakeholders, and how did that culture differentiate you?
Well, I'll give you an example, and this is, you know, the brilliance of one of the founders, Melinda Chouinard, Yvonne's wife. She was in charge of stores and what the stores looked like. And her philosophy, and this was very unique at the time, her philosophy was a store is a gift to the community. It is not about us making more money direct versus selling to a wholesale account. If we're going to put a store in a community, it has to be a gift to the community. So she started buying these, you know, old buildings and retrofitting them and refurbishing them to their original historic beauty. And it was truly a gift to the community. People would come in just to look at these stores. I mean, Newbury Street in Boston was one of the first ones she did. And people thought she was crazy to put all that money into those old buildings. And you look at that and look at what it's done. You know, for now, of course, that's avant-garde and a lot of people think like that in terms of differentiation. But that's some of the groundbreaking sort of ideas, the way that she thought about stakeholders. So community is very much, you know, part of the stakeholders. The society in general is a stakeholder. If you look at what Patagonia did, or you look at it's trying to change the world for good. I mean, all business pollutes. All business pollutes. There isn't one sustainable company in the world that I know of. So as they grow, they pollute more and more. So we have to be on a path to sustainability, meaning we have to look at every single opportunity to make it better, to have less impact on the earth. We have to treat our people, we have to treat the community in the best way we can, because turnover costs money. Loyal customers make you money. The customer acquisition is the most expensive part of any business. So it all makes sense. But ultimately, you know, 3/4 of the world's GDP is 500 corporations. Business has to change the world. That's where things are going to happen. And so every time that I'm able to work with a business and to be able to help them to understand that every single touch point of the brand is agnostic to the customer. And if you make sure that those values permeate through to the customer or any one of the stakeholders, ultimately you'll have that sustainable competitive advantage that you've been talking about.
Yeah. So as I think about this, and you've been the CEO of multiple companies, how does a CEO bring the board along on this conversation? Because, you know, if I came into most traditional companies, the kinds of companies that you've been talking about that have 3/4 of the GDP globally, you know, the board clearly understands the idea of differentiating for customers, because that's where you grow the margins. They understand shareholder value production. And they generally understand, you know, the environment and the community and the employees and the value of them, but sometimes the trade-offs seem to go towards, you know, okay, let's just please the heck out of the customers in order to please the heck out of the shareholders, and the rest of the stakeholders seem to suffer as a consequence. So if I'm a CEO and I'm trying to lead the conversation with my board, how do I do that?
Well, I would say that there's a rapid change going on. I remember talking to Steve Jobs about environmentalism and corporate social responsibility. And we had about an hour and a half to sit down and discuss this. And I remember something very, very poignant that he told me. He looked at me and he said, MC, he said, 15 years from now, corporate social responsibility and the environmental side of our business is going to be as important as the form factor of our products. And mm-hmm. And I just looked at him and just go, wow, nobody knows that side of you. And he says, hey, let me show you our new campus. And this was when they were just putting the new campus together. And, you know, he had a 3D rendering of it there in his office. And he was taking me through the biodiesel and the Bill McCready wind machines that he was going to put in. And, you know, all these things about the campus. And this is when the environmental groups were really after him for some of the components in the computers and not being able to change things out and things like that. So my point is this, is that even these iconic CEOs, they have an ability to see beyond the horizon. They understand the PESTEL analysis, the political, economic, social, environmental, technology, and legal side of things, and they see it way in the future beyond the horizon. And they're able to position their companies to do right by that from all stakeholders' point of view during the course. And that's how they talk to their board. They're visionaries. By definition, they see beyond the horizon. This stuff is not going away. The corporate social responsibility, the environmental side of of our business, it's not going away. It's only going to become more and more and more prominent in all businesses. And people that put their head under the sand and don't look at it, those are the companies that are going to go away.
I'm with you. I'm sitting here saying, preach, brother, preach.
Well, I just went to the Valley about 3 months ago with a group of SEALs that were transitioning out. It's called the Honor Foundation. We went to Tesla. We went to Airbnb, Pinterest, Apple, a few other companies, and all of those companies are talking about engagement in terms of their employees and having the best employees and having them their values aligned. And that is where it's happening. And those are cutting edge businesses that are very interested in the environmental and corporate social responsibility side of things. So I think that you're starting to see it on a pretty regular basis. And are there companies that are purely in it for the bottom line and next quarter's profit? Sure there is. But think about from 10 years ago or 20 years ago, it's nowhere near what it was then.
Shifting gears here a little bit, if there's a young CEO or a founder who's starting a company, what's one good lesson that you think you've learned along the way that you'd love to pass along?
Well, that's really simple, and that's transparency, honesty, ethics. You can get away short-term fooling people, but it doesn't work long-term. If you want people to really believe in you, you have to be an autotelic leader. Auto being self and telic from telos being goal. So you have to be motivated from intrinsically. This is what I am. These are my strengths. This is what I'm good at. And oh, by the way, all of you, you have strengths that I don't have. And I really need those strengths for us to be successful. And this comes full circle to the podcast because, you know, in the beginning we started talking about teamwork. And that's what it's about. You put a group of people around you and you make sure that they realize how important they are. It's not all about you. You have to realize that it's about a team. And to be an authentic leader means that you understand what you are and what you aren't. And people they see that in you. They will walk through walls to if there's a shared purpose that they agree on.
Wow. So, MC, if people were looking for you online or on social media, where would they look?
Well, Twitter, Dr. Michael Crook. MichaelCrook.com is my website.
Very good. Now, a call to action. Before we go today, what's one thing you would love for listeners of the podcast Social Entrepreneur to do?
One thing that maybe I would humbly suggest is really go back to that word being autotelic. And that means that you are intrinsically motivated. To get into flow, as Dr. Csikszentmihalyi says, to get into flow into that zone, the conditions that you have to meet are it's you're intrinsically motivated. It's not for money. It's not for titles. Not for what your parents think. You truly love what it is. There's a feedback loop. There's a high challenge, and your skill set matches that challenge as it goes further out. Your skill set goes out. That's when you get into flow, and that's when paradigms are broken, and that's when creativity, big C creativity, happens. So my advice would be is to strive to become autotelic.
Very good. Well, thanks so much for being with us on Social Entrepreneur.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thanks to you, the listener, for being with us today. This is episode 100 of Social Entrepreneur, so I wanted to take a second and give us a special shout out to you, the listeners. So thanks to all the thousands of people from more than 140 countries who have downloaded this podcast. You are the reason that I get up every day and that I do this, and I'm glad we found each other. So will you do me a favor, though? If you are a big fan of Social Entrepreneur, just spend 30 seconds, jump over to iTunes, look for Social Entrepreneur, and give us a rating and review, because it really helps us to get the word out so that more people can find this valuable content. Well, listen, thanks again for joining us today. And until next time, please remember to use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. We'll talk to you next time on Social Entrepreneur.